Take your Bibles and turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 18. Last part of the chapter. We'll pick up our study from last time. If you're using one of the Bibles in the racks in front of you, it would be page 221 or 229. Are you one of those people that when you see a picture hanging on the wall just a little bit crooked, does that really bother you? I mean, let's say you're at somebody else's house, you're a first-time guest, and if they have a picture that's just a little bit off, you feel almost compelled to walk across the room and straighten it out. I'm kind of that way, too. You know, sometimes we are that way about our lives. We can't stand to have something just a little bit wrong. And so we kind of live continually disappointed that there are crooked pictures in our life. It's like we want to fix everything, and we kind of live our life with the expectation, well, if I just wait a little longer, then this thing will work out. This relationship, this problem, this money thing or work or whatever. And we're continually disappointed. What we're going to see today in our study of the life of King David, so we're rewinding some 3,000 years ago, 1,000 BC, is that here's a man who was seeking to even fix some of the problems that he caused, and nothing ever seemed to work out quite right. And yet, he seemed to trust God in the midst of the things that weren't working out. In a sinful world, we need to accept some imperfect outcomes. We will never live at peace if we think that maybe tomorrow or next week or next year, eventually, everything is going to be just the way I want it. We're following the life of King David, as I said, and he has been going through many troubles. I want to just kind of give a summary of so we can kind of all be in the same story, because it's been a long story, chapters 13 through 18. But it's really about King David's family problems. It started when his son Amnon raped his daughter, which would have been Amnon's half-sister. And Tamar had a full brother, Absalom, who was bent on retaliation and eventually murdered Amnon. This gets serious. Absalom leaves the country, basically, just outside the border of the country, eventually comes back. When he comes back, he revolts. Absalom, this good-looking, charismatic type of an individual, revolts against his dad and claims the throne. And David, we looked at this last week, David then has to flee the country for his life. He leaves the capital of Jerusalem and goes off to Mahanaim. And as a result, there's a war. David wins the war. David's forces win the war. But David's son, who rebelled, Absalom, dies. And David had told his troops before this battle, be careful, don't kill my son Absalom. But Joab, the commander of the army, had the opportunity and killed him anyhow. You remember how the story, it's kind of a fascinating but gruesome story. Absalom, the rebel son, is riding his mule through the forest during this battle. And it says his head got caught in an oak tree. And we know he had this big head of hair. Maybe that's why his head got caught. His mule kept on going, and he was literally left hanging. David had said, don't kill him, but Joab says, no, it's in the best interest to kill him. So he killed him. So today, we see that although the forces of David had won the battle decisively, yet you see David grieving deeply because his son was dead. So where we pick up the story, Joab, the commander who had killed Absalom, has the unenviable task of sending back the message or the report to the king about the battle. And you see his dilemma. On the one hand, he has good news. David, we won. You can regain your throne. But he has to also tell him, your son is dead. So two messengers are sent from the battle to King David. And the two go running. I'm just kind of summarizing the last half of chapter 18. The two go running to David. The first one gets there and announces the good news that they won, but then he chickens out on telling about his son, Absalom, dying. The second one, who was a foreigner, a Cushite, gives this report. So let's pick it up in verse 31 of chapter 18. Then the Cushite arrived and said, "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you." The king asked the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man." In other words, "No, he's not okay. We killed him." The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Do you see the tension? On one hand, it's good news. We won. The bad news, your son is dead. Isn't so much of our life like that, where there's like two tracks? And one thing is going good, and yet what's bothering us is this is not going good. It's part of that imperfect outcome that we often live with. He was shaken. He was troubled. It's that feeling you have when you get the bad news. I'm sure many of you have experienced something like that. I remember being 12 years old when I was standing on the yard with my mom, and my dad drove onto the yard with the news that my grandpa, her dad, had just died of a heart attack in his 60s. Otherwise seemingly healthy, he's gone. I remember watching my mom. It's like, that is shock. David was experiencing this, and suddenly, we understand, because if you're a parent, you know, I mean, as evil as Absalom was, yet to David, he's thinking, this is my little boy. So we get the grief. But now do we see the dilemma? Because what about all those thousands of people, the soldiers, who had supported David in this war? How do they feel? Chapter 19, verse 1. Joab, the commander, was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day the troops heard it said, 'The king is grieving for his son.' The men stole," or like they snuck into the city that day, as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. In other words, it practically felt like they had lost. "The king covered his face and cried aloud, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh Absalom, my son, my son, my son.'" So the soldiers are feeling shame. And Joab, the commander, is the one that realizes this can't go on like this. So he's the only one with the courage to confront King David. Verse 5, "Then Joab went into the house to the king and said, 'Today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now.' So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway." I mean, who's got the nerve to talk to David like this except Joab? And David responds, gets up in his grief, and takes the seat at the gateway where the king should be. When the men were told, "The king is sitting in the gateway," they all came before him. David, Joab says, you got to get over, or at least rise above your grief, because all these men who risked their lives for you are feeling shame. As we think about the unresolved issues in our life, grief has to be one, because there is no shortcut in grief. David didn't just get over his grief. But David had to rise above his grief. And there are times we have to rise above our personal feelings and hurts for the sake of others. He chose to take control of his emotions because he saw the way it affected everybody else, because it's not a perfect world. You don't just get over these things. Sometimes when we have to rise above our personal griefs, we can feel hypocritical. It's not. We can feel like we're living a lie because this horrible thing has happened, and it's not a lie, it's life. Because you've probably been in a situation where you are in some way hurting deeply, but you have to function at a high level. You've been there, right? You got to keep going. You may have this terrible thing happening at work, but you can't come home and let it consume the way you treat your wife and kids. You might be going through a divorce, and yet you have to function at work and with the kids. You might have this friend thing that happened. You might have a health issue that is clouding your future. But life goes on, and you rise above it. And I believe that it is the grace of God to help us do that. And we shouldn't, you know, feel guilty practically, like there's this terrible thing, there's this thing. It's part of the grace of God to give us strength in the midst of that. I think it is God ministering to David that he's able to get up and sit at that gateway that day, because he knew his nation needed him. God's strength is obvious, most obvious, when we are going through something difficult. It doesn't change what's difficult. I was thinking of the Apostle Paul jumping into the New Testament era, who describes this tension, this seeming contradiction. But he talked about getting strength from Jesus Christ when problems are unresolved. For example, he was very persecuted for his faith. I mean, they stoned the guy. He wrote, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, God's still with us, struck down, but not destroyed." He says, we're always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus. So he says, I realize that following Jesus Christ means I will have suffering. And it's like, I can't remove that cloud, but it's so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. So it's like there's this contradiction going on. On one hand, there's this suffering. On the other hand, that's when I'm experiencing the life of Jesus Christ manifested in my actual body, my day-to-day practical life. Another time, Paul was struggling with inadequate finances. There's a very familiar verse that I think we forget is actually a financial context. When Paul wrote to the Philippians, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me," he was not using it like it's often used. You know, some Christian sports hero just won the game and I can do all things through Christ. It was actually a context where Paul was saying, sometimes I've had plenty of money, other times I didn't know where my next meal was coming from. But he said, I've learned to be content in every situation. And that contentment is where he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Being content when we are worried about our finances. Wow. That is the power of Christ. That's what a personal relationship with Christ does to transform us, because we can be content in that situation. It's supernatural. So God is at work while we're struggling. I think David was experiencing that. So he's experiencing personal grief while at the same time he's able to, with God's strength, and he talked constantly in the Psalms about how relying on him in tough times, God was giving him strength to function. That's on the personal level. There was also a huge issue going on nationally, and he's the king. Let me give you a little context of how things had been going in the nation of Israel historically. There had always kind of been two sides, two parties within the nation of Israel. There was the northern tribes, 10 tribes basically of the 12, and then there was the southern dominant tribe, Judah. So sometimes you'll see it's talking about Israel and about Judah, okay? It's kind of a north-south thing. Usually that's how the division was. But what kind of a conflict had they just come through? They came through the conflict between David and Absalom. That's father's son. They're both from the tribe of Judah. So the people who followed David, the people who followed Absalom were both within the nation, the tribal family of Judah. So it fractured Judah this way. It wasn't this way. Likewise, among the rest of the Israelites, some of the army followed David, some of the army followed Absalom. So you've got a different kind of a fracture within the nation that needs to be healed after this battle. Let's see how it develops. In verse 8, the middle of the verse, "Meanwhile, the Israelites had fled to their homes. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other." So that's within the northern tribes particularly. Here's what they're saying. "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He's the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines." In other words, historically, King David was our guy who delivered us. "But now he has fled the country because of Absalom. And Absalom, who we anointed to rule over it, is dead. He died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" He's saying somebody has to deal with this and get David back. He's the only king we have. So that's the struggle, the unity crisis. David has to handle this. David decides to handle it by, first of all, addressing the division within his own people, the people of Judah. Verse 13, he instructs the priests to talk to a guy named Amasa. Let me read verse 13 and then explain to review who Amasa is. "And say to Amasa, 'Are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not commander of my army in place of Joab.'" Absalom and David, opposite sides. When Absalom took part of the army, he needed a commander. Because Joab went with David, Absalom needed a commander, he appointed Amasa. So now you have competing commanders of the army. And both of them were nephews of David. And so they were cousins, kind of half cousins because of a different mom on the generation above them. So you have these two guys, and David says, "Who's going to command my army?" He says, "I'm really ticked at Joab because he disobeyed my commands and killed my son. I'm going to appoint Amasa." But I don't think it's just out of revenge. I think he is thinking about, what can I do to unify my tribe? I am going to appoint the guy who has been fighting to kill me. Do you think that was easy? I think it was very distasteful. His nephew has been trying to kill him. He says, "You're my new commander." Did it work? Verse 14. "He won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, 'Return, you and all your men.' Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan." They're going to bring the king back, so they come halfway to the halfway point of the Jordan River. So it worked, and he won the hearts of the people over. But he had to choose somebody that I think he didn't even like. Have you ever had to choose someone you didn't like? Have you ever had to work with someone you didn't like? Church staff, do not answer. I'm always worried about that guy saying something. Hard decisions. He had to give the authority to somebody who didn't deserve it. The picture was crooked. To have to work with Amasa. He has more hard decisions ahead of him as he begins to return to Jerusalem. Middle of verse 15, it says, "Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan." Let's just see where we're at in the geography. Remember, initially, David had to flee the capital city of Jerusalem, went to Gilgal, crossed the Jordan when he heard that Absalom was trying to kill him, and he went all the way to Mahanaim, and they had the battle in the forest. Absalom dies. Now they got to bring the king back. He's down to the Jordan River, but there are some people who come from Jerusalem to meet him at the Jordan River. Two key people to look for in this next passage. Look for the names Shimei and Ziba. Shimei and Ziba. And some of you were here last week. You kind of know who these two guys are. Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, hurried down with the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjamites, along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. So these two guys, They rushed to the Jordan where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and to do whatever he wished. When someone is like overly eager to help you, you sometimes wonder if there's like an agenda. These two guys, if you know the backstory, were very nervous about King David coming back. Middle of verse 18. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king, and said to him, May my lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind. Do you remember what he did? Shimei is the guy who had been hating King David for some 30 years because Shimei was the house of Saul and he never got over the loss of Saul and David's the king now. So when David was on down and out and leaving the city, Shimei's the guy who threw gravel at him, threw dirt at him, called him names and cursed him. And when he left the city, we saw last week, when he left the city, David said, let's not kill him. His guys wanted to kill him. He said, nah, maybe the Lord told him to curse me. Wow. But see, now the whole table has turned. Now the situation is that David's the winner, and Shimei realized, oh boy, am I ever in trouble. That's why he rushed out to talk to him and says, why don't you just put it behind you? Just forget what happened. For I, your servant, verse 20, know that I've sinned, but today I've come here as the first of the whole house of Judah to come down and meet my lord the king. Isn't that great of me? We'll come back to Ziba a little bit later. Now, if something like that happened to you, what would you do? Let's say that there's somebody at your job who has always had it in for you, undermined you, maybe even cursed you or something along the way. And now all of a sudden the tables are turned and they're kind of in trouble and you're on some committee and someone says, shall we fire him? Yeah, right? That's the chance you have to get back. Abishai felt that way, verse 21. Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed, and we kind of agree. But David replied, what do I have in common with you, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my adversary. I disagree entirely. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know that I am today king over Israel? I'm confident in my position. I don't have to prove anything. So the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king promised him on oath. And we're almost surprised at this. In fact, we don't even know if we like the way he's handling this situation. Did David suddenly start liking Shimei? No. Did David go soft? No. I think this is a hard decision. Did David fear Shimei? Not at all. But David wanted a united country. David felt that God wanted to pull the nation together. He knew David knew he had every right to execute Shimei and accomplish justice, but he realized the bigger picture was that he needed to bring peace to this nation. David knew there was a whole nation of people who were watching him saying, is David going to be vindictive on those who fought against him? What better way could David demonstrate, no, I care about all you guys, than to show mercy to Shimei of all people? Sometimes we show mercy for the sake of peace, even when we don't feel like it, even when someone doesn't deserve it. We trust God to accept that imperfect, unjust situation. We could take the hard line. Hard line always seems just, but sometimes we show mercy. At work, in our marriage, in our parenting, in church frustrations, in friendship groups where there's been hurt. We're going to always have the opportunity where we can get back. We'll have just the time we can say a certain thing and this would make him pay. But we realize the bigger picture is, in this case, not justice, but mercy. Because we're thinking about other people who would be affected, other people who would be hurt. So we're not going to carry out our little game or vendetta on the guy at work or the ex or whatever it might be. We're not going to say that juicy thing. And we realize life isn't perfect and we can't always have everything fixed and just and straight. Now, for those of us who are more justice-minded, you have to know the rest of the story. And this afternoon, if you want to, during halftime of one of the games, you can read 1 Kings 2 to find out about Shimei. Because when David eventually handed over the kingdom to his son Solomon, one of his instructions was, deal with Shimei, okay? He understood justice, but he says, I'm going to delay justice and show mercy. Now, what about Ziba? He's the other problem. I think Ziba came running to the river for the very same reason as Shimei, because, well, I think Ziba has lied. A little bit of backstory on Ziba. Ziba was the servant of Mephibosheth. We met him back in chapter 9. Mephibosheth was the grandson of King Saul, who had been David's rival. And back historically, David, after he had his kingdom established, wanted to show favor, grace to Saul's household as a unification kind of a thing too. And so he says, is there a descendant I can bless? They found Mephibosheth, this handicapped grandson of Saul. And David gave Mephibosheth all of his grandpa Saul's land as a blessing to him. Well, when David's in trouble and running out of town out of Jerusalem, Ziba shows up, the servant who David had assigned to farm the land for Mephibosheth. And David says to Ziba, what are you doing here? He says, well, I got all this gift for you. I got food to supply the troops and all that. Well, that's nice. Where's Mephibosheth? Oh, he betrayed you. He wants to become king. Okay, David says. And David says, well, if that's the case, I'm going to give you all the land I gave to Mephibosheth. Okay, that's how things were left. Well, now David's returning and we meet Mephibosheth and Ziba. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, verse 24, also went down to meet the king. He had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day he returned safely. It seemed he authentically was grieving because the king had left town, who had showed him such favor. When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? He said, my lord, the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I said, I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so I can go with the king, but Ziba, my servant, betrayed me. And he has slandered your servant to my lord and king. My lord, the king is like an angel of God, so do whatever pleases you. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord, the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who eat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? Basically, Mephibosheth says, I don't want the land. I'm just glad you're back. Now, that's kind of my understanding. I think Ziba's the liar, and Mephibosheth is telling the truth. But obviously, somebody's lying. Somebody's lying. What does David do? Verse 29. The king said to him, why say more? I order you and Ziba to divide the fields. Does that disappoint you, that verdict? Divide? I mean, if Ziba's lying, he should get nothing. If Mephibosheth lies, he should get nothing. It's a kind of a quandary to know, why did David divide it? But I wonder, is it because David didn't know who was telling the truth for sure? That could be. Or is it that he knew that Ziba would lie, was lying, but he realized that, you know, rather than creating division in the house of Saul, I'm just going to split the land 50-50. Ziba can't complain because he knows he doesn't deserve any of it. And Mephibosheth, he really wasn't into it for the money or the land anyhow. And there was peace. It's an incomplete justice. I mean, we're reading that going, come on, we like to see the... I mean, how do you want to see a movie end? You want to see the bad guy really get it. The pictures are crooked in life. The bad guys don't always get what they deserve. And here's another issue. Sometimes we just don't know the truth or what we should do as leaders. Sounds like parenting, doesn't it? Ever had a hard time figuring out who was lying? who started this fight? What do you do? And finally you go, well, both of you go to your room. You know, something like that. And I wonder if he's in that position. And sometimes if we just realize it's not going to be perfect. And, you know, are you going to make everybody happy as a parent, teacher, coach, pastor? No. The pictures stay crooked. If you're the obsessive compulsive type, this sermon is very unsatisfying, isn't it? You just can't get the thing straight. However, there was one refreshing person we meet on this way back to Jerusalem. His name is Barzillai, and we meet him starting in verse 31. Let me just tell you the story. If you were here last week, you know that when David and his troops got up to Mahanaim, they needed supplies, and God supplied three friends who brought all this stuff, food, pots and kettles, everything they needed. One of them was Barzillai. Barzillai, we find out in this passage, was an older man. He's 80 years old. He's wealthy, and he's generous. And he's a dear friend of David. And David, after this war is over, says, Barzillai, tell you what, come and live with me at the palace. I'm going to take care of you in your older years. And Barzillai says, thanks very much. However, you know, I'm 80 years old, and I can't see very well. I can't enjoy food anymore. I really don't think the royal life is for me. I'd kind of like to live out my days in my hometown, but thank you so much. How about I send you my servant, and you can just bless him and let him live at the palace? David says, okay. But you see the nature of this relationship? It just is kind of refreshing that in all of this unresolved, uncertain, unsatisfying results of everything that's going on after this war, that there is somebody who says, David, I'm just your friend. You know what? You don't have to give me anything. I just love blessing you. When we live with all these unresolved issues, we have a hard time seeing God sometimes. Because, you know, if there's an answer to prayer and we can put it down there and the money came in or the person apologized or whatever, that always feels great. But when things stay, you know, unresolved, how do you know God's at work? Could it be that we see God best sometimes in that person, that friend, who is like closer than a brother, right? Somebody who just accepts us where we're at. Barzillai, he knew David. He's 80 years old, so he knew the whole story. He knew that David had been this godly man. He had this terrible chapter of his life, and he had sinned and committed adultery and all that stuff. And yet he knew that David's heart was right. He says, David, I'm just here to support you. The way we know God is with us sometimes in the unresolved issues is when our friend, our Christian friend, is like God with skin on for us. And we need those people. You need to be in relationships where there's one, two, or five, or whatever people who know you. You can be transparent with them, and they just accept you where you are, and we want to be that friend for others. Many things are unsettled. Emotionally, David's still dealing with his grief, but he's functioning. Nationally, there's been this big division, and yet Judah is kind of been put together. And yet, you know how it is? When there's been conflict, even though, you know, there's some kind of a settlement, the war is over, you know, we agreed on this or whatever, the feelings don't go away. I mean, some people are still fighting the Civil War. Did you know that? I mean, there are just issues that people don't get over. Arguments that come up between a man and a wife usually, I tell you, you know, how familiar are they? How long have you guys been talking about this stuff? We keep coming up with the same familiar things, Priscilla and I. You have some guy at work, he just, all of a sudden, you see this conflict, it just erupts. And you realize, actually, you know, it goes back to feelings that go back, you know, 7 years ago when that thing happened. We know how that is. There's this atmosphere of resentment and some unsettled things that go on. And it's like we've got like dry kindling. And you're just waiting for the match. Let's see how this happens. David's problems aren't over. Verse 41, chapter 19, soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, now Israel, northern, got the 10-tribe thing, the northern people. They were saying, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, south, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all of his men? In other words, why were they the ones that escorted you home as if you're just their king? All the men of Judah, verse 42, answered the men of Israel, "We did this because the king is closely related to us. Why are you so angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves? I mean, we're related. What do you think?" Verse 43, "Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, 'But we have 10 shares in the king, tribes. Besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have, so why do you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? We brought it up first.' But the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel." Does this sound like middle schoolers or something? "I'm his best friend. No, I'm his best friend. No. I did this for the teacher. No, I did this for the teacher." You just kind of, 3,000 years later, we're looking at, hey, bring the king home. Does it matter who did it? And yet, we all kind of know those feelings we have if, boy, our friend didn't say this, or we felt snubbed by this, and all this kind of thing that goes on. And when there are these kind of enduring resentments and feelings, we're like that dry kindling, and who knows who's going to set that off if we don't deal with it in our heart, if we're not willing to live with some crooked pictures that not everybody's going to treat us right. The match shows up in verse 1. "Now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there." Just when you got all this north-south conflict, feelings and arguments and tensions and hurt feelings, all you need is a troublemaker. Anybody work? No, don't. You work with troublemakers, I'm sure. Here's Sheba. "He sounded a trumpet and shouted, 'We have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, O Israel.'" And incredibly, verse 2 says, "So all the men of Israel, the 10 tribes, deserted David to follow Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah stayed by their king all the way from the Jordan to Jerusalem." You've got to be kidding. I don't know how David... It doesn't say how David responded by this time, but I can almost see him going, "You got to be kidding. I've worked so hard to try to bring peace and got our Judah united, and I was trying to be kind to everybody else, and it all blows up again." David takes a deep breath and says, "But I still got to handle this situation." And so he says, "I've got to squelch this revolt of Sheba." And he sends... And this is so typical of our lives, too. It took three tries to get it done. He first of all sends his commander, Amasa, verse 4. 20, verse 4. "Then the king said to Amasa," he was the commander, "summon the men of Judah to come with me 3 days and be here yourself." But when Amasa went to summon Judah, he took longer than the time the king had set for him. So Amasa was his new commander, but he doesn't get the job done. He seems to be incompetent of getting the troops together, and this was a time-sensitive thing. We got to get after Sheba and squelch this thing in a hurry. He doesn't get it done. So, verse 6 says, try 2. David said to Abishai, now Sheba, son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom did. Take your master's men and pursue him, or he will find fortified cities and escape from us." And he picked Abishai, not Joab, notice. Abishai was a brother of Joab. He had always been a military commander. Amasa doesn't get the job done. Send Abishai. But then something happens. Joab actually was still in the army. Verse 7. So Joab's men and the Kerethites and Pelethites and all the mighty warriors went out under the command of Abishai. They marched out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, son of Bichri. While they were at the great rock in Gibeon, who shows up? Amasa came to meet them. The guy who didn't get the job done, somehow, I don't know if he just comes by himself, he said, "Well, I got to join in with the army." What kind of feelings had been going on between Joab and Amasa, do you suppose? Joab was deposed, fired, in favor of his half-cousin Amasa. And knowing Joab, those feelings didn't go away. And here's what happens. Joab was wearing his military tunic, and strapped over it at his waist was a belt with a dagger in its sheath. They typically would wear, they would carry a sword or something here, or a spear, but they'd have a dagger on this side. As he stepped forward, it dropped out of its sheath. And as we keep reading, we'll find out that it dropped out accidentally on purpose, probably. This was on purpose. So he's approaching Amasa, and his dagger is right down there. Joab said to Amasa, "How are you, my brother?" Then Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. That was okay back then. Amasa was not on his guard against the dagger in Joab's probably left hand, and Joab plunged it into his belly, and his intestines spilled out on the ground. Sorry about that at noon on Sunday. Without being stabbed again, Amasa died. Then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba, son of Bichri. So he kills him right there. The next part of the chapter tells how all the army had to march past this corpse going after Sheba. And suddenly, guess who's in charge of the army? Joab, it says, and his brother Abishai. Joab's the natural leader. Joab takes over. And actually, he's pretty good at what he does. So he eventually finds Sheba in a town about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. They got to go a ways. And so Joab gets the troops together, and they start building a mound, a ramp, to go over the city. Sheba's hiding out with his men in this city, running away. And he says, we'll just destroy the city, so we're going to conquer this city. So he's building this siege ramp up to this to go over the wall. And there's a wise woman in that city who calls out and says, can we talk about this, Joab? Joab says, all I want is to kill Sheba. She goes and talks to the elders of the city or something and says, we can do that. Next thing you know, here comes the head of Sheba over the wall. And that's the end of the story. Aren't you glad that you came to church today to hear such a satisfying story? Israel won, David won, the revolt is squelched, but the word gets back to David that guess who's in charge of your army now? Joab. In fact, verse 23 at the end of the chapter says, Joab was over Israel's entire army. I suppose David said, because he prayed a lot, he said, Lord, why? Why does it turn out like this every time? I'm trying to follow you. I'm trying to do the right thing. And the disappointing principle at the end of the story is that sometimes we are stuck with irritating people. That's real, real assuring, isn't it? And yet, with all the crooked pictures, will we trust God with the messiness of where our life is right now? Last week we were talking about God's providence, God's sovereignty, God's in charge of everything. Is he still in charge when life looks like this? The story of Israel is that God was always in charge. Even when David sinned and failed and then came back and tried to fix things and nothing was completely ever fixed, yet God was in charge. The familiar passage in our New Testament is that we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Yeah, we know. Very clearly, though, God is doing good things because God is good. Look at the world, it's good. There's a lot of beautiful things. God is doing good things, but God does good things through all things. And the all things are not so good. The all things are messy. The all things are uncertain, unfinished, unsettled, sometimes not completely just. But all things, God is doing something good in them. And that's where it boils down to trusting the God who is good. Johnny Erickson Tada, as we've shared this once before at least, a woman who, as a teenager, became paralyzed in a diving accident. Today in her 70s, I think she is now, serving God the whole time, never got healed, wrote that God permits what he hates to accomplish what he loves. God permits what he hates to accomplish what he loves. As we look at some of the messy situations of our life, to know there's a good God who is using all that messiness to accomplish the best things in us. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we confess that we don't like a lot of the things that have turned out in our lives. And we know you understand. And today we see that it happens to godly people like David. And if we are pursuing you, it'll still happen. And we know that there are some things that, where we begin to glimpse and see good things you're doing, there's other times that we don't. Help us to trust you with that which we don't see, because we understand your character, your love, your power, and your care for the big picture of the world, things that we will never see on this side of heaven, but that someday we'll understand. In Jesus' name, amen.